Well, good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking with anthropologist Emily Martin. She teaches at New York University and, among other things, is interested in the anthropology of science and medicine. And we'll be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in her book, Bipolar Expeditions. The subtitle is Mania and Depression in American Culture. The book is published by the Princeton University Press. And in it, she explains that some years back, she was diagnosed with manic depression. And it was not long after that, as a result in part of spending in support groups involving other people who have manic depression, she realized that this cultural phenomenon could be, and indeed turned out to be, her next ethnographic study, something that would be both ethnography and also something of a personal history. And the result is the book, Bipolar Expeditions. She makes the argument that manic behavior holds an undeniable fascination in American culture today. At the same time, people living with manic depression are often denied the status of being fully human. You can certainly read more if you go and seek out the book. And as we talk this morning, questions and comments are welcome. People who are listening can be involved in the conversation. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and dial the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the local number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one will work for you if it would be a long-distance call. So if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana over the air, or you're listening on the Internet, you can use the toll-free line, as long as you're in the United States, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Martin, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure, David.
We appreciate it. If you wouldn't mind, can you talk a little bit about your own situation and how it was that you came to realize that you indeed had manic depression?
Sure. I was, like many people, a person who was diagnosed with depression, episodic periodic depression, and medicated for it. And it took many, many years before certain experiences I had, which were not really part of the usual understanding of depression, such as imagining things that were a little out of ordinary life, led a new psychiatrist to suggest that maybe I wasn't suffering from depression only, but from bipolar disorder. And this meant for me, as it does for many people in that situation, a complete change of medication and also a complete change in how I thought about myself. To be diagnosed with bipolar disorder sounds much more serious, especially if you call it manic depression instead of bipolar disorder, much more serious, much more dire, much more, not normal, if I may say so, than simply depression. So this experience of suddenly feeling like I was a different kind of person, and I became very reluctant to admit this. I wouldn't really tell anyone, fear of repercussions in my job or repercussions in my relationships, made me realize that, as with many ethnographic projects, I had a particular vantage point from which to study this anthropologically.
We certainly know that in the United States today, depression is quite common and quite widespread. It's not always debilitating, but certainly can be a debilitating illness for a lot of people, and there are a lot of people who take medication for it. Having said that and understanding that depression can be a serious problem and that it's kind of widespread, how is it that or why is it that you think, perhaps for yourself and for other people as well, that manic depression is somehow seen to be even more serious, more debilitating, perhaps a more stigmatized condition than simply depression?
Well, therein lies the tale. It's possible that depression itself went through a similar kind of history to the one I'm trying to tell for manic depression. We all can think of people whose careers have been damaged by revelations that they suffered from depression and were seeking treatment for it. These days, and probably this has happened within the last 10 years, depression is much less, I don't mean to say that it's not serious and traumatic and entails a great deal of suffering, but it has a more acceptable public face, perhaps, today than it did sometime in the past, partly perhaps because of advertising for pharmaceuticals, the existence of a great many more drugs now than were the case in the past, the spread of the numbers of people with a diagnosis, and that you can, you know, in the workplace sort of pop your Prozac or the equivalent without feeling a great deal of secrecy and shame. It could be that something similar will happen with manic depression, but I'm interested in the processes that are happening before that's actually happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does seem to be the case that there are fewer, as far as we know, and of course one always has to question numbers like this, as far as we know, fewer people suffer with manic depression than depression. Mm-hmm. It probably hasn't been, our level of awareness of it probably isn't as great. Popular culture and popular media probably haven't dealt with it as much, and probably therapists and counselors haven't seen as much of it, unless maybe that's something that you make a specialty of. So for a lot of reasons, that it's more, it seems like maybe a more strange or unexplored territory, and if you don't mind that metaphor, maybe than depression.
Yeah, I think that's an astute observation. Fewer people lack awareness. Lack of awareness of the condition. I also think, you know, speaking from a sort of broader perspective of American cultural ideas about personhood, about who, what a proper person is, what a good person is, that manic depression compared to simply depression entails feeling that the person is more out of control, mm-hmm. lurching about from highs to lows. The state of mania itself contains a It's very fascinating. It's in some cases very desirable, but it's also frightening. You don't know for sure just what that person might do. And I think it's in part that, the sense that there's more fearful loss of control in manic depression than in depression itself.
Mm-hmm. For I'm just curious about how you feel about the terminology, because you have used the terminology manic depression, and I think that a lot of people still do use that, and for a long time, I'm sure, within the counseling profession, that was the term that was used for this condition. And although at somewhere along the line, we started to use the term bipolar disorder, and some people will know that, and some people, and we still are probably using both of those terms. Do you have a particular feeling about one or the other, and does that have something to do with the connotation of one or the other?
Yes, I thought long and hard about what to do about this, because as you say, they're both in use. The proper term as far as psychiatric, you know, categorization is concerned is bipolar disorder. But as Kay Jamison, who's written very eloquently and at length on this condition, points out, bipolar disorder seems strangely denuded of this complex darkness that surrounds a person who's moving between these extremely different mood states. And whereas manic depression seems very descriptive, it names it. It's a very strange juxtaposition of words, manic depression, and it kind of captures in a more direct, descriptive sense what the condition is about. So I opted to use that term mostly, although I have to follow the uses of my interlocutors, the people that I talked with in field work, and in particular of some patient advocacy groups, grassroots organizations that, after great thought, decided to shift from manic depression to bipolar disorder because they found that their members felt almost a kind of shame when the word manic depression was used to apply to them.
Let me introduce again our guest just very quickly, Emily Martin. She's a professor of anthropology at New York University. She's authored a number of books, including Flexible Bodies, Tracking Immunity in American Culture, From the Days of Polio to the Age of AIDS, and The Woman in the Body, A Cultural Analysis of Reproduction. And her most recent is Bipolar Expeditions. The subtitle is Mania and Depression in American Culture, and it's published by the Princeton University Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, as we explained at the beginning, part of of your interest here is personal, because you were diagnosed yourself with manic depression, and then you explained that at one point, it was not all that long after that, that you became involved in some support groups for people with manic depression. And it was at that point that you started thinking that, well, perhaps what you could do is you apply some of the fieldwork skills, analysis skills that you have as an anthropologist to this project of understanding manic depression, what that experience is like, how society views that, and so forth. How do you, what do you think it is that you bring as an anthropologist to this project?
Well, at the beginning, I really didn't know if there would be anything I would bring to it, frankly, because it seemed rather difficult to tackle a problem like this in an ethnographic manner. But I think there are a number of things I can say. First of all, by being able to participate in these support groups over quite a long period of time, I was able to see that this condition, manic depression, is lived by people just the way people live with any condition, such as being a certain weight or being a certain gender or race or ethnicity or wearing a certain kind of clothes. In other words, it's highly individual how they sort of wear the description. It ramifies through their lives, whether they're rich or poor, old or young, male or female. And observing these complexities on a day-by-day basis, I could see ways in which, although you might think someone with manic depression is kind of apart from the ordinary, their lives, our lives, are all ordinary in a certain sense. And in large part, the study is to spell out how that might be to understand even a very serious mental illness like bipolar disorder is something that people live within the fully human condition, in a sense.
When anthropologists do field work, if you think about the classic sense in which someone goes to study a culture other than their own, the idea is that the observer is supposed to be an outsider, in a sense, an impartial observer, simply observing, not involving herself in that culture, trying not to make judgments, just essentially learning as much as you can and writing down what you see and standing apart from. Now, of course, that's extremely difficult. It may, in fact, be impossible to do that perfectly, but that's the idea. In a project like this, it would have been impossible for you to be completely outside of this because this was in part about you, or it was always going to be in part about you.
Right. Well, you've just named one of the main topics that we wrestle with our graduate students. What is the observer's place in the field, and how to contend with ways in which you're not an outsider? And I think my own feeling is that you really can't be, strictly speaking, an outsider, no matter whether you share a diagnosis, as in my case, or you're, you know, in some other part of the world participating with people quite foreign to you. The people in the support groups, I think, put it very well. When I explained to them I was doing a study and wanted permission to continue to sit in, they wanted to know, had I been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and was I under the care of a psychiatrist? The reasons for that are it's a support group for people with bipolar disorder, and so you have to have that in order to be there. And secondly, they didn't want to contend with somebody who wasn't under the care of a healthcare provider. But that said, then they would say things like, well, you're wearing two hats. Mm-hmm. We all wear many hats. We're all doing different things. Some people come to the support groups and then write in their journals. Other people come to the support groups and then might write a short story or write an article for the newspaper. So my position was not unusual compared to others in the group. And my own understanding of what an ethnographer does is not to try to achieve some sort of objective outsider position, but rather to occupy more different perspectives, positions of perspective on the thing of interest than, you know, we can normally do in our everyday lives. So, for example, I spent a great deal of time in support groups, but I also went through the training process that medical students who are interested in psychiatry go through in medical school. I participated in a psychiatry department much the way I did in the support groups. I also interviewed a lot of pharmaceutical representatives who were selling to doctors the drugs that people are taking and so on. So occupying all these different positions, it doesn't give you objectivity, but it gives you multiple points of view from which to understand something.
Well, we have a caller. We want to bring them into the conversation. Let's do that. We won't make them wait any longer. Someone in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I have two questions. One that pertains to what kind of drugs are out there and how carefully are they supervised in terms of when they become available for the public. And just out of curiosity, I'm interested in knowing about your book, Flexible Body. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. Well, it's a huge topic, what kind of drugs are out there and how carefully are they supervised. Not sure you're more interested in when doctors prescribe them to patients or how they're brought into the market in the first place.
Well, that's hard to say. I guess I was thinking perhaps also she was thinking about how carefully they're monitored for potential side effects, mm-hmm. whether they're harmful or, mm-hmm. Because, of course, one of the catches about the way that we develop drugs is that by the time that they're actually made available to the public, it's still true that a relatively small number of people has taken them, and you really don't know what's mm-hmm. going to go on until you have a lot of people taking them, mm-hmm. and so you're still in a sense. I know that drug companies wouldn't like me using language like this, but in a sense, once a drug is made available to the public, it's still kind of an experiment.
Yeah, this was a huge issue in my field work, as it is for anyone who's in. Personally involved in these regimes of drug taking. I'll just say there's so many things I could say. Just one, which is that each drug that's available for any of these conditions has side effects and has particular desired effects. And you seldom find the desired treatment result with just one drug. You may have one drug that's having good effects but bad side effects. And so the tendency is to add another drug. Drug A has a good effect but a bad effect, so you add drug B to counteract the bad effect of the first drug, and so on. So people end up taking what are called cocktails of drugs. I do. Most people do. This is now a pretty standard practice. And it's really a complex maze to figure out, well, what's the drug, what are the drugs causing? What is just me? What is going to happen if I change the dose or change the combination? And psychiatrists and other healthcare providers try mightily, to the very best of their ability, to juggle all these things for the benefit of their patients. But there's a huge amount that's unknown, and most of these combinations of drugs are not studied beforehand. And this is called empirical dosing, which means it's by word of mouth, by shared experiences among psychiatrists, that these combinations are arrived at.
And this, I was really struck by that in that particular section of the book, where you talk about people taking multiple medications, spending an awful lot of time trying to figure out how they can be balanced, what their good effects are and the bad effects are, and perhaps also even, possibly from day to day or from week to week or from month to month, because the condition itself changes and perhaps the chemistry of the brain changes, they're having to try to figure out what the right combination of medications are for any particular time. And it seems both very time consuming on the one hand, and also just a real matter of luck, guesswork, experimentation. Mm-hmm. And it sounds as if no one can really, it's very difficult for any individual to say for them is going to work, be of the most benefit, have the least problems at any particular point in time.
Yes, this is very true. And one thing I was incredibly struck by was the extent to which if one can afford to have lengthy psychiatric consultations, the extent to which those consultations are taken up discussing drugs, as opposed to the older model of discussing, you know, personal relationships and so on. It's not that the latter is gone, it's just that it's, you know, giving way to the necessity to talk about all the things you're mentioning. And the fact of the reality of life, which is that most people don't have the luxury of that kind of psychiatric care, and for many of the people in my field work, they were on what the state would afford them, and that yielded 15 minutes per month with a doctor who could help them adjust their medications, 15 minutes per month to deal with these cocktails of drugs and all their complex symptoms, which is sobering.
Hmm. Now, there has been at least one big change in the last couple of decades when it comes to marketing pharmaceuticals, and that is direct marketing to consumers. Mm-hmm. Their manufacturers are still marketing, obviously, to doctors, but now more and more they're reaching out to individuals, and you see them in print and you see them on television saying, here's this medication, it's great, go and ask your doctor about this. And one can, I suppose, argue one way or another about whether that's good or not. And certainly, as there is a lot more information available now through the internet about medications, their potential benefits, their potential side effects, and I'm sure that people do try to share a lot of this information. They say, okay, this is what's worked for me, and tell me what you're doing. Do you think having people, individuals that intimately involved in trying to make decisions about their medications, is that a good thing or is that potentially not a good thing?
Well, you know, this is a double-edged coin. It's a thing with two sides that fight against each other because, as many of the pharmaceutical reps explained to me, the people who sell drugs to doctors, there is suffering that comes with these conditions. And so anything you can do, making the drugs more available, producing ads which make knowledge of them broader, might help reduce suffering as people find out, oh, this is what I have and this is the drug that could treat it. So one wouldn't want to take, you know, a position that ignored that important fact. But the other side of it is that drugs are profit items, and the important push to increase the market share of new drugs, to compete between one drug and another drug, shadows some of these other sort of human quality of life issues. And an example, a clear, I think, example of that is an older drug, very much older drug, lithium, which has been known to ameliorate some of the symptoms of manic depression since the 1970s, has lost luster in this current market. You don't see ads for lithium on TV. It's not a patented substance, and the profit margin for it is much less than the newer drugs. But lithium has been shown in scientific studies, I think people would agree, to prevent suicide in people with manic depression better than any of the contemporary drugs. And yet there's no kind of voice speaking for this in the public sphere. So I think that's kind of a casualty of our current system where the pharmaceutical industry is a profit-based industry.
We have another caller here. Let's talk with him in Rantoul, community not very far from here, line one. Hello.
Good morning. It's an interesting subject. I want to ask you about tardive dyskinesia and why is it so difficult to treat when the symptoms are produced in an individual that's taken those medications. And I'll get off the line.
Okay. Is that something that you know something about?
This is beyond my expertise, really. I know that it's a very dire symptom of some of the older psychotropic drugs, and it's it is, as the caller says, very difficult to treat. In fact, it's not treatable, as I understand it, and it's once it's in motion, that's kind of it. And it's one of the very real, in light of the what we were talking about just a second ago, it's one of the very real reasons why, say, pharmaceutical representatives feel it's important to get word of the new drugs out there, because the new drugs, whatever their fault and whatever their side effects, do not have this kind of irreparable damage associated with them.
Hmm. All right. Well, I think that's probably the best we can do. Let's go on to another caller, and this is someone in Champaign on line two. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
Three areas. One is, you were talking about the cocktails, you know, the combination and all that kind of thing. I also understand that blood tests should be taken to make sure that the level's high enough or something or other that. But how often does, or probably again the individual, is it the combination, from my understanding, the combination of cocktails will work for a while and then for some reason they lose their effectiveness. Isn't that the case? Or?
Yes, that is the case.
Yeah, and that's a pretty scary part.
Yeah.
The other one is that well, if we take just depression, there certainly is an element of the manic part where people go into sort of high anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that, you know, mm-hmm. is manic sort of really an extreme of high anxiety? Is that what happens in the manic?
Okay. Well, you're asking really great questions. The question of that where you mentioned a blood test to see how your levels are doing, I guess in a way one might wish there were blood tests to see how your levels of the newer drugs are doing. In fact, there is no such thing. The only drug for which there's a blood test is lithium, that old-fashioned one that's lost so much luster, and you do have to have blood tests to make sure that the level does not get too high. But the newer drugs can't be monitored that way. And the caller is absolutely right that very often a combination that's going along very well simply doesn't continue to have the same effects. And we don't know why that is. Maybe the neurotransmitters kind of wear out with a certain sort of alteration that's been achieved. And so then one might change the dose or add a new drug. And it's a continual process of adjustment and adaptation. The second question about where does high anxiety fit in with depression versus manic depression? You're pointing to the sort of art of diagnosis. Yes, high anxiety can be a part of depression, and it certainly can be a part of manic depression. Many of the conditions, if you look at the DSM, the manual for diagnosis that psychiatrists use, many of these descriptions of the conditions overlap. You don't find clear-cut boxes into which certain symptoms fall and not in other conditions. And so it's a kind of, they call it the art of diagnosis, the psychiatrists do, to try to see that a certain style of mood interplay is characteristic of that person and is really fits manic depression better than depression, despite the overlap of symptoms.
And then finally, I understand efficacy the treatment of depression is not, I don't know what I've read someplace, 30% or, you know, in terms of working, you know, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. Is that, in other words, it's not as high, I mean, I don't know, I guess years ago in terms of there was a study in terms of, you know, straight counseling. I know what you have has to be in terms of medication, but you know, treating by, you know, counseling, just straight counseling, which takes a long time, or medication, that they had similar results. But, you know, for some reason, they're having a hard time getting a handle on depression in terms of not exactly bringing it under control. Is that the case?
Well, what I would say is that this area you're pointing to is quite highly contested, depending on whose study you look at and who you ask. But one result, I think, that most people would agree has been shown, that the most efficacious way to treat depression is by combining medication and counseling.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the rates for, you know, amelioration through medication alone are not as high as anyone would wish, but it's agreed that you definitely can significantly cause those rates to rise if you combine it with counseling.
And then just a lot, which came to me, is what the electroconvulsive therapy, and that's sort of in extreme cases, right?
Mm-hmm. In extreme cases, yes.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Emily Martin. She's professor of anthropology at New York University. She's interested in, among other things, the anthropology of science and medicine. She is the author of the book Bipolar Expeditions. The subtitle is Mania and Depression in American Culture, and it's published by the Princeton University Press. One thing I wanted to ask you about, and perhaps some people saw some stories about this just recently in the news, that apparently the number of children and adolescents in the United States being treated for bipolar disorder or manic depression increased 40 times between 1994 and 2003. And this was apparently the result of the most comprehensive study yet of this, and particularly, I guess, not in adults, but in children and adolescents. And I just wonder, having thought a lot about this, what you make of something like that.
Yes, it is a stunning figure, a 40-fold increase between 1994 and 2003. Well, I think there are a number of different ways to understand it. Some people would say, well, the condition has been under-recognized in that age group, and so this is simply the process of recognizing it. Other people would say children are under increasing pressure in their lives at school with competition and mandatory testing and things like that, and so these higher levels of anxiety are, you know, actually increasing the incidence of disorders like this. I come at it from a little bit different point of view because I'm not really equipped to say why the rate has increased in those ways. But in my work, I've tried to trace the emergence of this condition from, you might say, something called manic depression into something called bipolar disorder, which is surrounded with fascination and desire. It's something that comes to be seen as associated with productivity, with a certain kind of creativity. It's even being taught as a skill that can be learned by training programs for corporations to learn how to be manic, to learn how to actually be manic, and then take that heightened energy and creativity back to the job. And it's not just young people that the diagnosis is spreading in. New York Magazine had an article a couple years ago the cover article was called "Are We All Bipolar?" And in a sense, the article claimed that bipolarity is just being a New Yorker. Here in New York, we're all bipolar, mildly speaking. We don't sleep. We're up at all hours. We're hypomanic. We are tremendously energetic. We're in creative fields and so on and so on. So I think the real question behind the heightened 40-fold increase is, why are we so fascinated by bipolar disorder today?
Mm. Well, I want to talk some more about that, and particularly a little bit more about this as you argue, this affinity that we have for manic behavior. But I have another caller, and I don't want to make them wait, so we'll get to them, and then we can come back to this.
Okay.
In Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
You had just begun to answer the question, or one of the questions I'd called, about social acceptance. When the program began, I suddenly flashed on Thomas Alva Edison,
mm-hmm.
who was said not to sleep at all sometimes and catnapped his way through genius. But I also had a medical question. A great many medications these days come with warnings such as may cause drowsiness, so don't operate heavy equipment. And I suspect that some medications may cause, as a side effect, depression. Do you know of any medications which cause some people to behave manically?
Okay, well, with the proviso that I'm not a physician, medications that cause you to behave manically, certainly. One of them is caffeine. And you might notice the great number of extremely loaded with caffeine drinks that there are around, legal drugs, legally drug-laced beverages that are just simply there to make you manic. And the ads convey that sense that you'll be up all night, won't need to sleep, highly energetic, et cetera. And, of course, then there's illegal drugs, which also can definitely have that effect and are deliberately used to have that effect. And as I mentioned earlier, there are not only drug means, but behavioral means that can be used to elicit incite mania. So you mentioned Thomas Edison. There are a whole list of people from the past and the present who are famous in one way or another for their creativity or their success in business and the arts, whose success is laid at the feet of either their manic depression, bipolar disorder, or their attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which are two conditions that are fairly closely linked.
Does that, caller, does that get at your question? Do you want to follow up? Or?
The first step, then we get to a definition. At what point or under what criteria does this usually socially accepted because they are functional or productive, at what point does it become a disorder? What step does one have to take? What line does one cross when suddenly people think in terms of an intervention?
Right. Excellent question. I'll tell you a story. During my fieldwork, I was talking with a psychiatrist from Los Angeles who practiced in Hollywood, and a good number of his patients were famous stars that you or I would know of. He said that when they came in for their appointments for treatment of bipolar disorder, they always came with their agents, and the agent's role was to make sure that they were medicated just right, not too depressed, not too manic, but certainly manic. So your point,
high energy state is attractive.
High energy, but still functional, highly motivated, in a way crossing boundaries, but not to the point of being unfunctional or even upsetting to other people. And that is the way, that's a pretty rarefied sphere, Hollywood, but just in ordinary life, this is how psychiatrists, in my experience and in my informant's experience, deal with the drugs. They're trying to optimize their effects so the person isn't numbed out and isn't too hyper, but can go out there with just that edge of just right energy. A lot of the drug advertising campaigns try to convey pretty much that same kind of optimized notion. Effexor, for example, had a big campaign which the tagline was better than normal. It's a drug for depression. So Effexor will take away the depression, but more than that, you'll be better than you were before you were depressed.
This also begins to sound like a military situation. Not so
kind of,
funny
yeah.
When I think about it. You need soldiers for life-saving purposes to be functional but vigilant.
Uh-huh.
And at a certain point, they become the stereotype soldier gone mad. But in order to stay alive, a certain amount of slightly more than normal vigilance is a good thing.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, especially these days.
Yes. Well,
and the topic of the use of drugs among fighting men and women in the military is one I'm fascinated by and don't know very much about. But we do know that, among people who have to work for long hours, like airplane pilots and railroad engineers and so on, it's a highly controversial issue about the use of drugs.
Right. Well, I appreciate the time for the conversation. Thank you.
All right, thanks.
You're welcome.
I guess I'm just interested in kind of underlining here this big idea that you explore in the book, and it does say that we're kind of confused about how it is we feel about these things, where on the one hand you could say that manic depression was seen as generally seen as a very debilitating illness, and that it scares us because it suggests a person that's out of control because of the swings. So so manic depressive illness in someone who had manic depression would make us nervous. And yet at the same time, we have this thing about mania that is in certain people in certain occupations, maybe people in the business world, people in the entertainment world, people who are scientists, people who are inventors, whatever, people who have this intense energy that they seem to be able to channel productively into their work. That's something that fascinates us maybe we find reasons to admire it, to be attracted to it. So we have this very odd way that we're thinking about these things that are related and yet different. And in the one case, we get very scared of it. In the other case, we'd say, not only do we think that that's good, but, you know, if you can give me a can of something I can drink and I can, and you go, you know, give me a Red Bull and we'll go off and have a great time. It's a very strange, we're strangely of two minds about this.
Yes. Well, you put it so well. Exactly. And then there are, like, one example I think that captures the two-sidedness of it was the experience of Howard Dean, who was very much admired and liked for his energy and his creativity in the political sphere. And then he went too far. He did that scream thing.
Yeah.
And then the descriptions of him doing that, which always mystified me about what was so bad about it. But anyway, it was described as a manic grin, a barbaric yawp, as if speaking of lines, he went over some sort of line and became less the creative, energetic, new view of the world kind of successful politician and became a frightening person with mania. And he really suffered because of that. And that shows the kind of the high stakes that are involved in trying to juggle these lines. You're not really sure always where they are. And you're in one is in a social setting in which these sorts of things that are seen as some kind of life force, vitality. Maynard Keynes called this kind of thing animal spirits, are considered essential in the economic domain for CEOs, for people in corporations, in the advertising industry, the art world, and even in academia. And yet, you're playing with fire because it may go over into something that's considered scary and dangerous.
Yeah, they're just,
you're an individual, you may plunge from that into depression.
Yeah, it just shows that our relationship with mania is complicated, and it's not, our support is not unqualified. Particularly if it is, as you say, that there's some line, but we're not exactly sure where it. We know when it's been stepped over, but we're not exactly sure where that line actually is.
Yes.
Our guest in this part of Focus, just very quickly, let me introduce again our guest, Emily Martin. She's professor of anthropology at New York University, author of a book that explores the subject that we're talking about here. Her book is Bipolar Expeditions. The subtitle is Mania and Depression in American Culture, and it's published by the Princeton University Press. We have about 10 minutes left. We have a couple of other callers, and I want to try to get them in here. We'll go next to Champaign in line 2. Hello.
Hi, Professor Martin.
Hello.
You mentioned lithium as being a medication that the level can be monitored. And I wanted to point out a couple of others, carbamazepine and Depakote and valproic acid are also monitored for their therapeutic levels.
Okay.
And but that was just a side point. I had a question about the efficacy of medical treatment and therapy, and I would agree with you that the two together are far more effective than one by itself. But I'm wondering how much of that is could also be attributed to a therapist taking the place of a doctor and more frequently monitoring the patient's progress.
You mean the therapist doing what a regular family doctor would do,
or a psychiatrist,
or a psychiatrist? So these days, yes, I think you have a very good point that these days it would be sort of the line between therapy on the one hand, separate from drugs, and drugs on the other hand, separate from therapy, would be blurred. Is that your point?
I'm not sure. The caller hung up, so we'll have to go on what you heard. And
okay. Yeah. Well, if that was the caller's point, then I think it's a good one that the place of the therapist has come to be in part dealing with the ins and outs of drugs, or if the therapist feels he or she is out of their depth to find someone who has that expertise. So drug talk, drug monitoring, drug optimization has become a part of all almost all contexts in which people seek any kind of therapy or help for psychiatric conditions. Mm.
But I think the point that you made earlier, and I think that it is something that would concern a lot of people, is that for some individuals who have psychiatric conditions, the way that they're being treated almost exclusively with medication, and mm-hmm. that there is the argument that that's good, but that also some therapy would help as well. But, you know, depending on who you are and what resources you have and how your health care is delivered and paid for, that just might not be an option. So it sounds like there are a lot of people out there who are just basically going it with medications and maybe indeed in some part trying to figure out for themselves what of those things work.
Yes. I constantly feel I have to state that I'm not a physician and not an expert in the medical aspects of these things, but any brief period of time spent browsing through any of the many, many, many news groups devoted to people who struggle with these conditions will show you the extent to which trying to figure out the drug dosage and side effects is a preeminent preoccupation.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone else. This is a listener in Urbana and line number 3. Hello.
Oh, hi,
hello.
How are you? Very, very good subject. Thanks, David. This is a good show. I was going to say, in the military aspect, you might want to look into recent papers published on air crews from CONUS, the United States, or Diego Garcia flying missions in Afghanistan and Iraq. And because these bombers, long-range bombers, have really small crew space, I've read where crews are given amphetamines to stay awake, mm-hmm. basically. But in the late 60s or the 70s, I was in a combat unit, and I always just tell people that I basically didn't sleep for 2 years. So, when I got back, I had, you know, that sort of decompression, and I found myself looking at, I used to drink warm beer there, but I couldn't decide whether when I got back, years later, whether it was an adjunct to my mission or a repression of my mission, you know, alcohol as the drug of choice. Mm-hmm. Using like marijuana or things like that, but mm-hmm. I'm just curious as to the military part is real interesting because when you're in a situation like that, you know, basically you cannot be, well, if you're screwed up, you're going to get killed. If you're not screwed up, then how do you deal with it? That kind of thing. So, but yeah. I thought maybe if you mentioned the military aspect, I thought maybe you could look into that. I know there's some papers on the web on that. Mm-hmm. But whether they're medicinal, they're from a medical viewpoint, not a military viewpoint. But I'm not sure whether, I mean, I understand this, but I went ahead and got a bunch of degrees and had a business and everything. But a lot of people would say I get in these stages where I would be, like, wired for a year. You know,
wow.
I design all this stuff where I'd do all this work, and then I'd, uh-huh. like, say, I don't want to do anything for 6 months. And,
uh-huh.
So I sort of ended up like that, but I'm not sure whether it was the experience I had when I was 19 through 21 or whether I'm just that way anyway. But thanks for the
sure.
show, David.
You're
it's
welcome.
Really interesting,
well,
thank you very much.
I
appreciate it. Yeah.
Sure.
Thank you for your comments. It just shows the extent to which we need to know more, understand more about these things, and say the effects of amphetamines on life after one has taken them is something we know little about. One thing about the military and development of drugs in relation to combat, the Village Voice ran an article a couple of years ago about developing drugs to counteract post-traumatic stress disorder, which, you know, that would be a good thing, right, to have a drug that would prevent a very debilitating consequence of combat, sometimes post-traumatic stress disorder. But the drug operates by having people not be able to remember what they experienced that would have otherwise caused them to have post-traumatic stress disorder. And that gets kind of complicated. Do we really, you know, what are the social consequences of having soldiers put in situations where they see certain things and do certain things and then can't remember it? And as a consequence, don't have these bad psychiatric effects maybe, but there would be other social effects of that kind of lack of memory. So it's really, really fraught. Probably everything that I've ever tried to understand about drugs in society is 10 times, 100 times more complex in the military situation and very important for us to look into.
Yeah. Well, I want to try very quickly to get one more caller. Champaign, line one. Hello.
Oh.
Yes.
I am a musician and diagnosed as an adult with ADD and dealing with a child who has a number of different behavioral psychiatric issues. And as a medical dropout, probably because of the ADD, I've done quite a bit of study into this. And I've been talking to many friends who are therapists and psychiatrists and things. I've come to understand this whole thing as a spectrum. So everybody's brain is different. There is still no reliable way to look inside somebody's brain and decide what medication they might need for this or what for that or how it's going to work. Amphetamines, for instance, for somebody who has ADD, is not going to keep them awake. It's going to modify mm-hmm. the ADD, but they'll sleep well.
Mm-hmm.
But the with all of these, the manic depression is a spectrum. And I think that I firmly believe that everybody has it to a certain extent. And a previous caller, I think, asked at what point does it become something you have to treat? And, well, when it becomes something that negatively affects your life, you have to deal with it. If it's something that is positively affecting your life, well, that's a good thing. And many creative artists, many musicians have been bipolar, and it's, mm-hmm. it's aided them a great deal. Mm-hmm. But not mm-hmm. everybody follows the example. I had a boss, for instance, who was bipolar. He would be manic for years at a time,
mm-hmm.
and then go into a six-month deep depression that mm-hmm. he had to be brought out of. But it's these things, I think, have to be recognized. Medicine plays percentages. They arrive at the diagnosis, the diagnostic manual, DSM-4, out of synthesis of many, many different cases and arriving at the symptoms that are presented to most people, and therefore they come with a diagnosis.
Yeah, I've got to, forgive me, caller, I'm very sorry to have to do that, but I've just got to jump in here because I'm at the end of my time and we're going to have to stop. With our thanks to the guest, and Emily Martin, and again, the book, if you'd like to look at it, Bipolar Expeditions, published by the Princeton University Press. Emily Martin is a professor of anthropology at New York University. And Professor Martin, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.